Still smiling, she let his wallet fall into her shoulder bag and moved on. She dipped a Rolex from an unzippered fanny pack, a stray iPhone from an end table, and another wallet from a hip pocket. Not bad for a few minutes of work. But then, the scent of wealth was tactile here. The men's eyes were avaricious. Once she would have reveled in all of this. She hadn't known any better, and that had given her tremendous power. But not now. Haley was staying at the El Toro Motel, a two-story red-tile roof affair that looked more expensive than it was. She parked under a pepper tree and climbed the outdoor staircase, fake wrought iron that wobbled against the stucco building. Sighing wearily, she unlocked the door to her room. She longed for a hot bath and her old jeans. Then she would decide what to do next. Cracking open the door, she watched the key-size receiver in her hand. It flashed hot red. She jerked up her head. Someone had been in her room. Maybe still was. Not the maid, because she had put a hold on housekeeping services. The flashing light was triggered by a pressure reader thin as paper, the size of a dime, she had stuck low on the inside of the door, where it would close against the jamb. The first time someone opened the door, there was no flash. There should be no flash now. So this was the second time, or third, or more. Staying calm, she pocketed the reader and inched open the door, making no noise. She had oiled the hinges when she checked in. The long rays of the afternoon sun painted a golden rectangle into the room, leaving the rest in uneven shadows. The closet was closest. A glass oval was in the door. She peered through. She had hung no clothes. The closet was empty. The door to the bathroom was closed. Chapter 14 by Andrew F. Gooley.
"I knew you were bound to turn up,"
the voice of a man said. Her heart skipped a beat. There was no turning back now. She stood for a moment between the bathroom door and the closet.
"Come in, Haley," the man's voice went on.
She stepped inside and saw a man seated at the desk. It took her a while to recognize him. John Nunn, the detective who'd questioned her years ago about Christopher's disappearance. She was actually relieved. Nunn had gone off his rocker. He wasn't a danger to anyone but himself.
"What are you doing in my room? I'm calling the police."
Nunn laughed.
"Yeah, you do that, sweetheart. And while you're at it, you might want to tell them about that stolen Rolex in your handbag."
How would he know?
Her mind was working furiously.
"What do you want?"
She tried to keep her voice calm.
"Sit down. Make yourself comfortable."
He gestured to the bed. She sat down and said nothing. She looked at his face and noticed how he'd aged since she'd seen him last. His eyes looked tired and puffy, and the lines between his eyebrows had grown deeper.
"I've been tracking you for a while," Nunn said. "Larceny, confidence games, all that good stuff you've been up to."
"What do you want with me?"
Haley could hear her voice shaking.
"I still have some questions about your dead lover, Christopher Thomas."
"Are you crazy? It's been 12 years. That's over and done with. He's dead, she's dead. You can't resurrect ghosts, Nunn."
Her mouth was dry with fear.
"It's not ghosts I'm trying to resurrect. Anyhow, if I were in your position, I'd humor any cop, even a discredited ex-cop, who had questions for me."
She gestured with her hands for him to continue.
"Listen," Nunn said. "Thomas was a womanizer, but he didn't pick just any women. They were always of a certain type. Classy, well-educated girls who he could be sure would never blackmail him. Pardon the barb, but you never fit that mold. So why would he get involved with a crooked little tramp like you?"
"Was that a statement or a question?"
she asked, opening a bottle of water that had now gone warm in her bag.
"Drugs?"
She didn't say a word.
I know enough about you so that if you don't cooperate with me, I'll make sure you see prison. And by the time you get out, that pretty face of yours will look like a beaten-up old tire. I may be discredited, but I still have a few friends at the SFPD. She tried to calm herself down. He couldn't do anything to her. He was a washout. The case was closed. You know, they probably have closed-circuit cameras at the Ritz.
What do you want to know?
Chapter 15 by J.A. Jantz. When Nunn left, Haley was standing in the middle of her room and looked up questioningly at her image reflected in a cheap mirror. She didn't like what she saw. She had walked away from that long-ago life. She had done everything she could to put it behind her, but here was Nunn reopening all of it, using any compromising information he had been able to glean about her to get her to cooperate with him. She still wasn't sure how much he'd managed to uncover about her life. Had he been following her, watching what she did at the Ritz? He must have. Anyhow, she couldn't be in this room anymore. She knew that he might be waiting for her outside, but she had to get out again. Shielding herself from view, shoulders up, head down, she hurried along the path until she reached her car. Once she was settled in the front seat, she started the engine and punched her foot down on the accelerator. Hang on, she advised herself. She needed to concentrate on her driving as she raced through the neighborhood as if it were a Formula One course. She exited the immediate neighborhood with a series of maneuvers designed to smoke out and lose any tails. She couldn't afford to be followed. At the moment, she was giving an excellent imitation of someone who hadn't a care in the world. She rolled down her window and let the damp, ocean-scented air wash through her long red hair, leaned back in her seat and relaxed, or pretended to. She thought, Rosemary Thomas was executed for murdering her husband 10 years ago, and now, all these years later, that detective is trying to use me to uncover facts about Chris's past, while Tony Olson has invited me to this memorial even though I was never Rosemary's friend, and I was screwing her husband. Why? Haley stared at the road. Who wins by opening all these old wounds? She thought again about Chris. She was over him and had no reason to kill him. But of course, she had lied about that to the cops, and to herself, that she was over him, could so easily quit him. She sighed. It wasn't as if she were still in love with Christopher Thomas after all these years, but she still wasn't over what he'd done to her. The man had taken something from her, and that loss had yet to be recouped. But why celebrate Rosemary's death? What's the point of that? She thought again about Nunn. Last she heard, he was drinking himself to death, and his wife had walked out on him and had married the Thomas's financial guru. Why couldn't Nunn let it all die along with the Thomases? What if he didn't keep his word and she did go to jail? She pulled into a Burger King and stopped at the drive-in microphone. She was suddenly starving and needed time to think. She needed to go over everything she could remember about the people who were in any way involved in Chris Thomas's death. She ordered a number one without cheese and a Diet Coke. Ordering at Burger King made her feel even more as if she'd fallen on hard times. Chris Thomas's murder and Rosemary's subsequent execution had been a blight on the lives of any number of up-and-coming folks who were no longer so young or up-and-coming, including her. Especially her. She parked on a side street and ate the burger, thinking about Christopher Thomas and the woman who she knew had come after her, Justine Olegard, his associate curator at the museum. At least that bitch got a permanent job out of the deal, she thought bitterly. What did I get?
Diary of John Nunn by Andrew F. Gooley. 2 days before the memorial, and I don't have much to go on, but I feel close to finding out the truth. Don't give a damn how I find it. All I know is that it won't be in a courtroom. The press won't be descending like vultures. And there won't be an ambitious DA talking about how the state has to protect itself from the likes of Rosemary Thomas. Years ago, when the pain used to become too much, I'd go down to the subway and stand on the edge of the platform, wondering if I had the courage to take that final step as the train approached. It's the same reason I still go to bars. There's one about a block from where I live. Drab place, dark, mostly empty, smells weird. A big, tattooed black guy is always at the bar shining glasses. Never says anything. I order a Jack Daniels on the rocks and take a whiff of that comfort brew and dare myself to take a drink. Before Tony rescued me, whenever I'd feel that emptiness that used to threaten to rip my soul apart, alcohol always helped numb me up. Now, set against the shiny bar, moisture around the glass, the ice cubes glistening, it still looks good to me, but I won't touch it. I just stare at the drink, knowing that draining that 6-ounce glass will take me back down a hole from which I'll never climb out. Tonight I stared for a long time into the glass and saw a faint reflection of myself staring back. Usually the rest of the dancing ghosts join the show. All of them, Sarah, Rosemary, Tony, Chris Thomas, like actors taking their place on a stage. Who would haunt me tonight? You know whom I saw tonight? My dad. Saw him when he was my age, tired and on the roller coaster of addiction. I got up, put my jacket on, and went out into the night. When I got to my place, I walked past a bum and into the hallway that led to my tiny apartment. I never open windows, and as soon as I open the door, the stuffiness of times gone by is always there to greet me. I took off my shoes and lay on the sofa. The phone rang. I picked up. "John Nunn?" I heard a tired voice say on the other end. "Who is this?" "It's Hank Zacharias." I respected Zacharias, but I didn't know him well. "I left the SFPD years ago, so if this late-night call is about a story, I can't help you." "That's not what it's about. Look, I need to talk to you. I need help. I think I can help you." "Are you drunk? Your voice sounds funny." "My mouth's busted up, that's why." "What happened?" "I'll tell you when I see you." He gave me his address. I had nothing to lose. Better this than another endless night remembering the execution. The day Sarah walked out on me, every mistake, every regret. I took a cab to Zacharias's place, a ramshackle rent-controlled apartment that smelled like curry. Zacharias wasn't at the door waiting for me, but the door was unlocked and I went in. He sat hunched over on a wing-back chair, his face cut, eyes swollen. "What happened to you?" Looking closely, I realized his nose was broken and had been packed. "Who did this?" Zacharias took a gulp of his drink. "I don't know. He was wearing a mask." "Was it a mugging?" "I wouldn't call you if I'd been mugged, Nunn. I'd go directly to the police." He was breathing from his mouth and kept reaching for his drink. "Okay, Hank. Why did you call me?" I sat down on the sofa. Above the gas fireplace that looked as if it hadn't been used in years hung a large print portraying Che Guevara, and under that a small Greek Orthodox cross. Zacharias took a moment to collect his thoughts. "I got an invite to that memorial," he said at last. "And?" "You know she was innocent." What else would Zacharias want to talk to me about? "I'm pretty sure she was, now." "Now? Now that you can't help her? Why didn't you cooperate with me?" "The evidence pointed to her. That's what I was called to testify about. That's what I did. And then everything went in one direction after that. I tried to stop it, but I couldn't. I'm still paying for my mistake, Zacharias." He didn't say anything. "So what happened to you?" I asked. "I've been asking questions again about the case." He tried to smile. "I found this guy used to work security at the McFall at about the same time Chris Thomas disappeared. He used to be a cop at one time, Artie Ruby. I'd heard of Ruby. He'd been kicked off the force for misconduct, but I hadn't known he'd worked at the McFall. So much for my investigative skills. So, the McFall Art Museum hired an ex-crooked cop to provide security. Didn't they do background checks back then? Zachariah shook his head. Amazing, huh? So who did this to you? I don't know. Ruby wasn't happy with the questions I asked him. And about an hour later, I was walking home and some guy wearing a mask beat the crap out of me. You think this Ruby had something to do with it? I don't know. Zacharias leaned back in his chair. You know, Chris had all sorts of connections. The rumors were true, I'm pretty sure of it. Problem was, Chris never understood you don't fuck with those guys. They have a way of dealing with deadbeats. And Ruby's connection to all this? That's for you to uncover, Detective. My first instinct was to track down Artie, break an arm and a few ribs. I hate bullies, and I hate rogue cops. But there was more than one way to skin a cat. I left a note in her hotel room and then drove to Dunkin' Donuts and waited. She showed up an hour later. Haley hadn't changed too much in the last 10 years, but her eyes were even more cynical than they were in her youth. She slid into the booth across from me. "What do you want?" she asked. "Typical call, gal," I said with a smile. "Sorry about that note, but I thought it'd be better than sneaking up on you in your hotel room again. So how are you?" "Tired of being blackmailed by a disgraced ex-cop whom the world has abandoned," she said with a sigh. "Excuse me, but I have to get a donut. Those sour creams are incredible. Want one?" I admired her pluck. She came back a couple of minutes later with a cup of coffee and a donut. "I've done my homework, Haley. And if you were going to spend a couple of years in jail for what you did the other day, I've managed to find more stuff that will keep you in for a long time. The mail fraud scheme in New Mexico, the old wealthy trucker in Montana who died of a heart attack just a month after you married him. Then we have your dealings with Chris Thomas, fencing off stolen artwork. I can go on and on." She continued munching on the donut, then smiled and said, "You're going to have a hard time proving it, though." "Maybe I can't prove it, but I can make life very complicated for you." She didn't say anything, so I went on. "I need some info, Haley, and you're the only person I know who can get it for me. Unfortunately, it'll probably involve screwing an older, greasy guy called—" "You don't have to blackmail me to screw a smelly old shit." She paused. "I will, of course, charge my standard rate." I dropped an envelope on the table that had $400 in it and said, "I come prepared."
Chapter 16 by R.L. Stine. She looked so right on the bar stool, as if she belonged there, as if she were born there. I spotted her long red hair from the doorway, saw the dip of her shoulders as she picked up her glass. I watched her rattle the ice cube. She took a sip. Her expression didn't change. I realized she was eyeing me in the mirror behind the bar. "Artie, don't get involved," I told myself. I wasn't in a mood to be nice to anyone, or even pretend. So, why was I still there? And why do I do anything? I had that feeling of dread I wake up with every morning, you know, that cold, heavy rock in your chest that makes you pull the pillow over your head and scream into it until you can't breathe. Or maybe you don't know that feeling. Okay. She saw me watching her. I tried to study her reaction in the mirror, but the neon Sam Adams sign cast a flickering blue glare over her face. The drunk on the next stool bumped her arm, but she didn't spill a drop of her drink. She turned her green eyes on him, gave him a stare I've seen a few times. He raised his shirt collar as if he were suddenly cold and moved away. Time for more lies. That's the way I approach the day. What's my favorite film? The Grifters. Not sure what made me think of it as I stepped on my half-smoked Marlboro and walked toward the bar in its neon glow. Hi, is this seat taken? She turned, and her eyes were cold. If I had a collar, I would have turned it up, but I was wearing a black turtleneck, sort of my uniform. Is that the best you can do? Her voice was deep and throaty, a smoker's voice, but she didn't turn away. I'm a slow starter, but I finish well. She lowered her eyelids and flashed a quick half-smile. She wore a designer suit, stylish, a navy blue pinstripe number. Her legs crossed under the skirt. In the mirror, I saw the white blouse unbuttoned to reveal some skin. Gave me a pang. She set the glass down. It had her lip prints on it, a smear of red-brown. I tried a smile while I studied her. Veronica Lake, Nicole Kidman. She had the looks and the moves, but something was missing. Maybe I think that about everyone. My problem, right? I slid down onto the stool next to her. Something about her was familiar, but maybe I think that about every woman I meet. Who knows? I motioned to her empty glass. Buy you another one. She turned the green eyes on me. Green for go?
You talked me into it, she said, rattling the cubes.
Yeah, that's me. I've got a way with words. Artie, don't sound bitter. I waved to the bartender, a little blonde number who looked about 12. That half smile again.
What else have you got away with?
I just laughed. It sounded strange to me. Guess I hadn't laughed in a long time. So, okay, we had a few drinks, maybe more than a few. I'm a Jameson guy, too, maybe the only classy thing about me. We were there a couple hours, and what was I thinking? I was thinking maybe I didn't have enough to cover the tab. I was thinking about excusing myself to the little boys' room and then cutting out the back door. So, imagine my surprise when she leaned against me and pressed her face to my ear. She smelled like oranges and flowers.
Can we go to your place?
I didn't move for a long moment. I wasn't expecting that. Most women can pick up right away on what a loser I am. I squinted at her, trying to decide if maybe she was a pro. She shivered.
Saturday night is the loneliest night of the week, right?
But it's Friday. Her lips brushed my neck.
Let's pretend it's Saturday.
I don't need this, I was thinking, but I'm weak. I'll be the first to admit it. If a chick presses her face against mine, all soft perfume and whispers, what am I going to do? Say no. And then we stepped out on Brannan Street and waved at a taxi. As we climbed the stairs to my apartment, I was feeling a nice buzz, kind of warm and forgetful. I closed the door behind us, clicked on the table lamp, and reached to take off her jacket. She glanced around. She was still in the shadows by the entryway, but I could see she wasn't smiling, and I knew the word she was thinking, shabby.
Artie, you said you had a condo in the Embarcadero.
No lie, I said, raising my right hand. It's being renovated.
And so you took this walk-up dump on Mission? It looks pretty lived in to me.
I forced a laugh. Do we come up here to talk real estate? I tried to clear my head. I didn't like the way this was going. I shouldn't have had those drinks. I couldn't think straight. I took a few steps back, you know, to assess. She took off her own jacket and folded it neatly over the back of my ragged armchair.
Is your name really Artie?
Her silver bracelets rattled. She had like 6 or 7 of them, her hands clasped and unclasped at her sides. Yeah, my name's Artie. Want me to show you my driver's license? She actually said yes, so I did. She studied my license like she was going to be quizzed on it, said,
Arthur Ruby. It's got a ring to it.
I shrugged. She shivered again, not from the cold, I guess. She took a step, snuggled against me.
That's a little better, I thought. I wrapped my arms around her. She sighed as I raised my hands to her tits, and then she started asking me questions. And it's weird, 'cause I heard myself answering, even though I didn't want to, but I couldn't stop, and the room was spinning. Then we were in bed and we were having sex, but the whole time she was still quizzing me and the damn room wouldn't stop whirling. So, how was the sex? Not bad, I guess. I mean, sex with a total stranger is always good, right? Okay, maybe I was a little distracted or even worse, but my head didn't feel right. But I was pretty sure she didn't notice. It had been so long since something good happened to me. I kept thinking about what it takes for luck to change, for something to fall your way. Next thing I knew, she was all dressed and brushing back her hair and putting on her jacket, and I was up, though shaky, moving to open the door, ready to offer a few tender goodbyes. I'll call you tomorrow, and all that. But then her face changed, and she didn't follow me to the door. She crossed her arms in front of her. Even in the dim light, I could see her face was flushed. Was that a shadow or a lipstick stain on her chin? She stuck out her hand.
I want the bracelet back,
she said softly. I blinked a few times. Bracelet? She rattled them on her arm, like she was showing me what a bracelet is.
I was wearing 6, she said. I put them on your bed table when I got undressed. Did you think I can't count?
I shrugged and wrinkled my forehead and did my innocent act, like I couldn't follow what she was saying.
Did you hide it while we were in bed? Just give it to me.
And she turned the cold green stare on me. I squinted at her. You think I'm a thief? I had that feeling I get, that sharp pain in my chest, my throat all tight. The first time I thought I was having a heart attack. After that, I knew what it was, and I knew it was something I had to deal with.
It's fucking Cartier. It's an antique Cartier bracelet. I'm not leaving without it.
You're crazy. I don't have any bracelet. My heart pumped up a little. I pictured the bracelet where I slid it between the mattress and the bed frame.
Stop the bullshit,
she said, and she sighed like a bad actress.
Do you think I won't call the police?
I didn't think she would, but I said, police? An angry cry escaped my throat. The pain in my chest grew sharper, and I really felt my heartbeat race. I'm not a thief. She took 2 quick steps toward me. Her fists were tight at her sides.
I think you are. Give me the bracelet.
Give it to me, thief. She didn't make a sound when I slapped her face. Just blinked her eyes and worked her jaw up and down. I was surprised how soft and warm her skin felt against the back of my hand. I could breathe again, but I was instantly sorry. My hand throbbed with pain, but that wasn't the worst of it. I knew I'd screwed up. She rubbed her cheek, the green eyes accusing me. She still hadn't made a sound. I kept hearing the slap. I'm sorry, I said. I didn't mean it. I didn't mean to do that. Really, no lie.
Are you fucking crazy?
She whispered. You know what? Here, I'll get your bracelet. I'll give it back to you, and that'll be that. Everyone happy. Hey, no problem, okay? My hand shook as I pulled the bracelet from its hiding place. I gave it back to her. She stared at it in her hand, just stood there gawking at it, like she never thought she'd see it again. No hard feelings, I said. How dumb is that? She glared at me one more time, brushed her hair off her forehead,
pulled her jacket tighter around her and disappeared out the door. I was breathing hard, wheezing a little. I stared at the door as if I expected her to come back. I rubbed my fist. That was an example of how I lose it. It only took a second, and there I went. But the whole thing was messed up. I knew I wasn't angry at her. I knew who I'm really angry at. It's anger that's been in my chest for 10 years. I can't get that Christopher Thomas job out of my head. It's there with me every morning. It's the dread. It's the cold dread. I helped. Did my job, and I expected to be paid fairly. Maybe I was naive, but I thought those guys would spread it around like they said. Naturally, they didn't. Not enough, anyway. When was I born? Yesterday? And here I was, 12 years later, stealing a bracelet from a woman in my bed. How low can you go? Finding yourself desperate like that can make a guy angry. So now I'm going to do something about it. That's what I decided. Standing there, looking at my bruised knuckles. That's what I decided. I'm going to get what is mine. And I started feeling shaky again, like maybe I was going to pass out. And I realized that bitch slipped me a roofie. Jesus. I've slipped a girl or two a roofie in my time, so it's, like, only fair, but... hell. Why'd she do it? I started remembering her asking me all those questions, but for the life of me, I can't recall a single one or what I answered. Shit! What'd I tell her? What the fuck did I tell her?
Chapter 17 by Marcia Talley. Sarah Ballard plumped up her pillow and stared at the clock on her bedside table, watching the digital display quietly snick, snick, snick through the minutes as she relived the previous evening's events. She didn't need to turn over to know that her husband's side of the bed was empty. 8:23 a.m. If Stan had returned home after walking out on her following yesterday's argument, CNN would already be blaring from the living room TV, and the smell of fresh coffee would be teasing her nostrils. The house was silent. But whom was she fooling? Her marriage to Stan had been foundering for some time. An unlikely pairing to begin with. He an up-and-coming estate lawyer, and she a cop's wife. She thought about how they had come together. It was the case, of course. The case she had pushed John on. Pushed him even when he'd told her he had a hunch the evidence was skewed. The case that ruined so many lives, but brought her and Stan together. He entered her life at a time when she was vulnerable, showered her with love and attention while John was disintegrating. Stan was ambitious, exciting, while John had always been a bit of a dreamer. But now she had come to see those very qualities that had attracted her to Stan as nothing more than an example of his unmitigated selfishness. She slipped out of bed. If Stan didn't want to go to Rosemary's memorial, she would. She owed it to herself, to John, to her previous life, the one she'd lost the day Rosemary Thomas was put to death. It was noon. John Nunn usually got up around this time. He couldn't face the morning gloom. He got out of bed, headed to the kitchen, and straight for the coffee maker. The doorbell sounded. He yawned as he made his way to the door and opened it. Sarah, his ex-wife, stood on his doorstep. Stylish heels planted firmly on the mat that said, "Go away." Sarah, looking as beautiful as the day they were married, before he fucked it all up. But he could tell from the swelling around her eyes that she'd been crying. He massaged the sleep out of his eyes, half convinced that when he removed his fingers she would have disappeared. But Sarah was still there, smiling apologetically and saying, "May I come in?" John shrugged, stepping aside as she walked into his living room, suddenly embarrassingly shabby and small. Coffee? I was just putting some on. She raised a bag, holding it by its brown, string-like handles. Coffee? 2%, 3 sugars, right? She'd remembered. John took the coffee, thanked her, then pointed to the love seat, glad that he'd picked up his dirty laundry the night before. I can't say I'm not happy to see you, but why are you here, Sarah? He took a sip of his coffee, waiting for the answer. A certain invitation? John raised an eyebrow. You got one, too? Not me, exactly, Stan. And what does Ballard say? John asked, although he told himself he didn't give a shit what Ballard thought or said about anything. She shrugged. We don't see eye to eye on attending the memorial. He says we're too busy and that we should just send flowers. She stopped, and looking down at the floor, said, But she was innocent, you know. John laughed out loud. That's ironic. Didn't you say I was obsessed? That I should be locked up in a rubber room along with my goddamn briefcase and a gallon of Jim Beam? I know what I said, she said quietly. But I've had a long time to think about it. Have you? Yes. They stood there a long moment, looking at one another. None not sure of what he should say or do. Since Tony Olson's invitation came, I've been thinking about it even more, and... None raised an eyebrow. Well, the invitation was for Stan, and I don't care if he doesn't want to go. I was hoping I could go, that you would take me. Another long moment, then John Nunn did what he'd wanted to do, had thought about doing for a long time. He took his ex-wife in his arms and tugged her toward him. John, no. She pressed her hand to his chest. That's not why I came. Nunn didn't say anything, just dropped his arms and turned away. Later they had dinner at a nearby cafe, where brick-oven-baked pizzas were served on proper white tablecloths, and copper pots and sailboats dangled from the ceiling. Talking, laughing, like old times. Only this time it didn't take booze to grease the wheels. They were in bed by 11, separate beds. Sarah curled up on the double, hair spread out on the pillow, smudges of blue under her eyes, a bolster at her back, and the duvet tucked under her chin. Nunn claimed the sofa and the remote control and fell asleep in the middle of Leno. 7 a.m. now, and she had hardly moved. Nunn got up, fetched his briefcase, then closed and locked the bathroom door. He perched on the toilet seat, balancing the briefcase on his knees. He eased open the catch, soundlessly, and began pawing through the contents. As familiar to him now as the deepening lines on his face when he studied himself in the mirror every morning. A newspaper clipping, yellow with age, detailing Rosemary's trip to Mexico, where she told friends she knew that Chris would never be coming home. Stupid-ass thing to say, Nunn thought. Like that crazy nurse in Maryland who offed her husband with succinylcholine chloride, on Valentine's Day, no less, after telling colleagues exactly how she'd do it. Nunn studied the black-and-white photos of the Thomas children, Layla and Ben, that accompanied the article. The same brown hair and inquisitive eyes as their mother. But where Rosemary's hair had been long, Layla's was cropped and curly, almost the same length as her older brother's. He wondered if they'd show up at the mother's memorial. He exchanged the article for crime scene photos and a transcript of the trial, where he had testified for over 2 hours. The evidence he had found in the back of Rosemary's closet, the blouse stained with Christopher's blood and the missing button that had been inside the Iron Maiden, the strands of Rosemary's hair in Christopher's fist. Damn. Nunn slid an issue of Vanity Fair out of its protective plastic sleeve, the one he'd saved for over a decade. The one containing the pre-execution interview from death row at California's Valley State Prison for Women. Nunn flipped to a picture of Rosemary wearing an orange jumpsuit and white sneakers. He skimmed the piece and reread a line here and there. Rosemary telling the world her story. How Christopher had asked her for a divorce. How they had fought at the museum. How she'd stormed out and how sad and desperate she'd felt. but that she had not killed him. "So your husband was a whoremonger?" the interviewer had suggested. And Rosemary, ever dignified, had refused to answer. "So how," the interviewer had asked, "did your husband's body end up in the Eisener Jungfrau, the Iron Maiden that was on loan to the McFall?" Rosemary claimed she had no idea. "And all the evidence against you?" Again, Rosemary could not supply the answer to a world waiting to hear a confession from one of the few women who was slated to die by lethal injection in the state of California. Nunn closed his eyes and rested his head against the cool bathroom tiles. He remembered the exact moment he'd seen the magazine at a newsstand. By the time he got around to reading the article, it was 2 days after Rosemary Thomas was dead. He put everything neatly away and closed the briefcase. He washed his face and shaved and eased into the same shirt and trousers he'd worn the day before, then gently shook Sarah by the shoulder. "It's 9 o'clock. You getting up any time soon?" Sarah moaned and pulled the duvet over her head. "Go away." Nunn smiled. It suddenly felt as if they were an old married couple. "I'm going out for breakfast. A cafe just across the street. Want to join me?" The duvet shrugged. "I take that as a no." "I'll be down soon," muffled. Nunn stared at her a moment, trying to decide what it was he felt. It was like some B-grade movie. His beautiful ex-wife asking him, not her current husband, to escort her to such an important event. But the ache he felt in his heart was all too real and definitely not part of a script. Nunn settled into a chair with a cup of Italian roast coffee and a copy of USA Today. He had read through the life section and started on sports, but he couldn't concentrate. What did Sarah really want? Was her marriage to Ballard coming apart? Nunn was picturing Sarah from the night before, fantasizing about whisking her off to some place exotic such as Rio or Bali. When she finally made her appearance, she looked fresh and bright, her hair still damp from the shower. She laid a hand on his shoulder. "I'm going shopping." "For what?" Sarah straightened, extended her arms. "I can't wear this to the memorial now, can I?" In Nunn's opinion, Sarah looked spectacular, her extraordinary body in a white scoop-neck sweater and tight jeans. He raised an eyebrow. "I guess not. Coffee?" He indicated the chair opposite him. She flapped a hand. "No thanks, gotta run." She executed a delicate about-face, waved, and was gone. Nunn watched her disappear down the street. He downed a second cup of coffee, then left the cafe, walking down North Point to the Embarcadero, and wandering up to Grant near Pier 39. It was unusually quiet for this time of day, he thought, but the back of his neck prickled, as if he was being followed. He turned and thought he saw something, but then there was no one, and he walked on. A few blocks later, he felt it again. This time when he turned, he was sure he caught the shadow of a man. He sprinted after it, but when he rounded the corner, the alley was empty. Enough, Nunn thought, and headed back to his apartment. He still needed to tie up a few things before the memorial this evening. He starts the car and follows the ex-wife. When she goes into a department store, he parks, cuts across the street, makes his way past counters of women's perfume and makeup, men's underwear and cologne, keeping the ex-wife in his sights only yards ahead. A few shoppers between them, mostly women, and it's early. The store practically empty, so he's got to be careful. He almost swats a bottle of cologne out of the saleswoman's hand after she sprays him with something he thinks smells like rotten oranges. And she catches enough of the expression behind his metallic aviators to back away, mumbling apologies. Damn it, where is she? Has he lost her? He looks left, right. There she is, half an escalator between them now. As the ex-wife browses the dress department, he moves to a table of cashmere sweaters, head down, pats and caresses the soft wool as if it were flesh. Three or four dresses draped over her arm, she disappears into the dressing room. He waits a minute, surveying his surroundings, and when he's sure no one is looking, darts in. He spies her legs under a cubicle. She is the only one in the dressing room. He stands in a room opposite, the door closed, and when she comes out wearing one of the dresses, a short silky number, and twirls in front of the mirror, he watches, holding his breath until she heads back into her room. Then he bolts, pushes her forward, locks the door behind them, gets one hand over her mouth, another around her waist so hard the air goes out of her with a gasp, and he whispers in her ear, "Do not make a sound or I'll kill you." A noise escapes her throat, neither scream nor gasp, just the smallest squeak like a yelping puppy. "You don't like the dress?" he whispers. He gets a hand under the silky fabric, then pushes the strap off her shoulders and tugs the dress down till it puddles around her feet, and she is in her panties, and he tightens his chokehold and feels her body tense and whispers so quietly it's little more than a breath. "Tell him to stay away from the memorial for Rosemary Thomas." The ex-wife says nothing, trembles. "Did you hear me?" His lips graze her ear. She nods several times, even though his hand is still pressed tightly against her mouth. "Tell him your life depends on it. Do you get that?" His breath in her ear causing more chills. She nods emphatically. "You'll tell the ex-cop to stop, won't you?" "I need to hear you say yes," he rasps, as he slightly eases his grip off her mouth and chin. "Yes," she says. "Good." His hand tightens around her throat and she smells his breath and feels his beard against her neck and tries to turn her head for one look at his face but can't move, and he says, "You'll tell him." Just then she hears women's voices and is about to call out, when he pushes her to the floor and sprints out of the room, and the women scream. And then he's walking past shoppers and racks of clothes, and pushing past people on the escalator, and weaving around the makeup and perfume counters, until the hot, damp air hits his face, and he keeps walking, not once looking back. And not until he's driving along the Embarcadero does he start breathing normally again.
Chapter 18 by Thomas Cook. Some love-stung Lothario had once called her hair a curtain of flame. Haley had liked the phrase at the time, and thought it so appropriate now, as she gazed at herself in the mirror, that she half expected her brush to throw off sparks. Her beauty drew attention, and most of the time she liked that attention, but not tonight. Tonight she'd prefer no eyes follow her once she arrived at the Mafal Art Museum. Instead, she hoped to drift almost invisibly from room to room, a little ghost ship flying its red pennant. Tonight she had to be a huntress, and it would be better, safer, if she went about unnoticed, like some bejeweled old dowager, dripping diamonds and pearls with a slack neck and smelling like a mixture of camphor oil and Chanel No. 5. She'd even, briefly and absurdly, contemplated wearing a disguise, then dismissed the idea because she knew the guest list would be small, and there'd be no crashing this event. But then, who'd want to crash a memorial service for a woman who'd been executed 10 years before? No, she'd have to go as herself. Haley Patchett, flaming hair and all. But once at the McFall, what then? She considered the options, the method. She'd have to mingle with people, pretend she was there for the same reason as everyone else, to remember poor dead Rosemary. She'd have to listen to stories of how great Rosemary had been, how smart, how clever, all of which had, of course, made her grim end just that much more tragic. And grim it had certainly been, as Haley imagined it, strapped to a gurney, nameless people inserting needles, someone reading her death sentence in a low, mournful voice. She cringed at the thought of Rosemary's execution, and how somebody would no doubt bring it up, and she'd have to stand there, listening. But at some point she'd drift away, and with any luck, no one would find it particularly unusual that she walked from room to room. She'd have to stop and pretend to pay attention to whoever interrupted her ramble. But after a time, she could pull away. And at those moments, just as she stepped back, she could allow her eyes to search for the room. Briefly, she considered the information she had got out of Artie Ruby. That crazy cop Nunn had blackmailed her into sleeping with Ruby, hoping to uncover something about Chris's murder. Instead, Ruby had pointed her to a bit of information that would prove useful to her. Apparently, she was not the only one of Christopher Thomas's lovers who had been involved in the stolen art racket. The respectable curator of the McFall Art Museum, Justine Olegard, was another. Haley was willing to bet Justine didn't quit that lucrative little side business once Chris was murdered. It would take some nosing around, but Haley was sure she'd find something damaging in Justine's office, something that would put Justine exactly where she wanted her. And soon, Haley would get the train wreck of her life back on track. She glanced at the clock. Not much time left. And out the window, one of those dense San Francisco fogs had drifted in. That would slow traffic to a crawl, so she would need to hurry up if she wanted to get there early enough to look around a little before anyone spotted her and came over to talk. Hurriedly, she applied the last of her makeup. This had once been reassuring, but time was beginning to make it a lesson in the things she'd done wrong and now couldn't change. The thought that always returned to her when she noticed some new crack in her mirrored portrait. At the McFall Art Museum, Justine Olegard reached for her drink the way others reach for a brass ring. She looked at the little painting that had hung in a dark corner of the gallery for ages, 10 years at least. Tony Olson had made a big deal of its installation, a last wish for Rosemary. Part of the museum's permanent collection, it was now installed behind a locked glass display case as if it were the Mona Lisa. Here it moldered in obscurity in this quiet room that didn't see much traffic. She knew the artist was a friend of Rosemary Thomas's, and the installation was a tribute to her friend, honoring her for all patrons to see. Museums were haunted by such paintings. They were the naughty kids who were never introduced to guests, and this one now struck Justine as naughtier than most. Something about it was tense, gave off a disturbing little charge. Looking at the waves, you sensed something underneath them, a shadowy presence, silent, stalking, preparing to surge upward toward a pair of struggling white legs. Some paintings truly spoke, and this one did. Its true subject was the dark undercurrent of things, she thought, and the creatures that lurked there. She examined the signature. B. McGuire. Belle McGuire. Rosemary's friend. As this night had approached, a night Justine had been dreading, she thought about her time with Christopher. She recalled the many things they'd done together, the tightrope she'd walked between the personal and the professional, and even the legal and the illegal, and how, at certain moments, she'd quite helplessly fallen off. Christopher would have liked this little painting, she decided. He would have liked its deceit, the way it played the one-eyed Jack. He would have admired its skill for betrayal and misdirection, the way it turned the sea into a shadowy back alley. And what about Rosemary? Rosemary, who had always believed that something good could not have something evil at its core, Someone would probably say all of this about Rosemary during tonight's memorial service, and Justine knew that she would nod and agree while all the time imagining the world beneath the world that this dead woman had never glimpsed. Or maybe she did. Justine walked to the window and looked out over the city. The white signature spire of the downtown San Francisco skyline was hung in fog. Sheathed in fog, like a knife. Wrapped in it, like a shroud. The McFall Art Museum was only a few blocks away now, and Tony Olson knew that once his limo turned the corner, he'd be able to see its lit windows. The elegant place was also oddly playful in its overall design. The curl of the stairs that wound up to the exhibition floors was almost impish, and the bright colors painting the lobby were like a middle finger lifted at the old lady interiors of the Uffizi and the Louvre. He had always loved to seed his philanthropy with a sense of mischief. He knew that the kid inside him was a nasty little bastard, and as his limousine turned the corner and the McFalls swam into view, he could see his own nastiness on full display. How dark and amusingly impudent, he thought, to use an art museum to memorialize a woman put to death for murdering her husband. Sure, Rosemary had requested it in her last will and testament, but he took no pleasure in what he would normally have found a deliciously inappropriate juxtaposition. Something about Rosemary had actually penetrated his otherwise quite impenetrable character. He had played the mystery man all his life, and most of the time he had played it convincingly. Once a reporter had asked him how he wished to be remembered, and he'd replied, not without accuracy, as a blur. But Rosemary had somehow seen through the illusion he had created and lived behind. It was as if she had drawn the cloth up from one corner of the masterwork, seen only that tiny bit of canvas, and yet, with stunning intuitiveness, had grasped the work as a whole. The limousine stopped abruptly.
"Sorry, sir," the driver said. "A cat just ran in front of us."
Olson glanced out the window and through the light mist saw the cat as it leaped onto the curb, then stopped and looked back at the black car it had so narrowly avoided. It was black with white feet like a dancer's shoes, and for a moment it stared directly into Olson's eyes, haughtily, as if it had proved its point, defied the odds again. But how many escapes were now left to it? Olson wondered. How many lives, before chance, turned the tables at last? John Nunn's gaze swept over everyone as they assembled in the room. They were like ornaments on some grim tree, each hanging from its own withered limb. Sarah stood silently beside him. Why had she come, he wondered now. She had no relationship with either Rosemary or Christopher. He glanced over at her stunning, sphinx-like profile and thought of the last time they'd been here together, all those years ago at the fundraiser for inner-city park programs. She seemed tense, more so than usual, but when he asked her about it, she shrugged it off. Perhaps she had come out of some weird nostalgia, since it was Rosemary's case that had broken up their marriage. Sarah had always been good at keeping old wounds open, and he supposed she was busy plucking at whatever scabs she'd since gotten from Stan. But Rosemary was a different story. Sarah had not even known her. He shrugged. Maybe she'd just needed a night away from Stan. Who wouldn't, after all?
Chapter 19 by Diana Gabaldon. The fog laid its frozen hand on the back of Haley Patchett's neck. The day had been a summer dream of sun and heady breezes,
but the fog had rolled in just after sunset, and the air that rattled the palm fronds now was straight out of Neptune's bait locker, dank and cold, with a whiff of dead things. 10,000 goosebumps were on her bare arms, her flimsy silk evening wrap no bar to the piercing, unexpected cold that so often rolled into San Francisco. The museum's courtyard